Welcome. You're listening to the 21st episode of the Extensive Reading Podcast, where, Travis, what do?
We take an intensive look at extensive reading. Yeah. I'm Travis Past, along with me.
And here's Jose Camino. And thanks, everybody, for tuning in. And also, thanks to all the listeners we had for our episode number 20. And
yeah, thanks to our listeners, and thanks again to John Pasden and Jared Turner for both giving us the interview and also sharing.
Sharing it with the world. And I think they must have done a really good job, judging judging by the numbers of listeners we had.
We had a spike. So thank you. We hope you came back and are listening again.
Yeah.
Thanks
to the Exploring EFL Fluency in Asia Facebook group for sharing us with the world.
That's great. I really appreciate that.
Yeah. If you have a Facebook group or just you're just a regular Facebook user, or you want to share the ER podcast with the world, that's more than welcome.
We encourage sharing.
And yeah, for today and for our next episode, we have an interview which I think is very special. That's an interview with Dr. Rob Waring. Whenever we ask our guests in the past, who should we interview next?
Always.
Yeah.
The first name we've always heard is Rob Waring. And it had been a long time coming. He's a busy guy, and we'd been trying to set up an interview. And finally, our schedules aligned. The stars aligned.
Yeah.
And here it is.
So I really hope you enjoy it. Just in case there's somebody who doesn't know Rob Waring, he's one of the founders of the Extensive Reading Foundation and one of the most visible supporters and promoters of extensive reading. And he's also an author of Graded Readers, of a particularly successful and popular collection called Foundations Reading Library, and also he's published Page Turners too. And I'm sure there's other collections I'm leaving out. And he's been involved with extensive reading in many ways for a pretty long time. Yeah.
And so for this first episode, we'll be kind of talking about his history with extensive reading, and also kind of, how'd you put this, Jose? The mathematics of language scream at us.
Sort of a quote from the interview. Yeah. It's not just me. But this is the idea that, without wanting to spoil the whole interview, but he echoes this idea that if you're not going to do extensive reading, then the numbers don't add up in terms of the number of encounters.
Just exposure that one needs to the language to acquire it. So we won't spoil anymore.
Yeah.
Other than that will be the topic for this interview. And then for our subsequent episode, episode 22, we'll be getting more into his experience of writing and editing Graded Readers. So.
Yeah, so I think that, without further ado.
So should we start? Okay.
All right.
So could you please tell us about your background and how you got involved with extensive reading?
Okay. Well, I was, first of all, thanks very much for asking me to come along and give my views on extensive reading. I was born in the UK, lived there till I was 18, and moved out to Australia, did my undergraduate degree there, and worked for a little while. And I spent quite a bit of time in the 80s traveling around. I traveled around the world for a couple of years, Australia through to the UK, and then UK and back again. And I'd always loved traveling and wanting to go places. And my dream was to be able to travel and work, because, of course, you need money. And so someone suggested to me that I might want to teach. And, of course, you know, my first reaction was like, no way, not going to do that. And so anyway, I thought, well, okay, anybody can teach a language, right? It has to be easy. I'm a native speaker. I'll be fine. Little did I know. Anyway, so I took a course in London. I did my CELT, my diploma, and started to teach a little bit in London, and then later on in a bit in France, in China, and where I was for about 3-4 months or so teaching, and then moved to Australia. And as I went through the process of learning more about language teaching, I really got into it a lot more than I thought I would have done. So I ended up getting a diploma, and I moved to Japan, got my master's degree, got heavily involved in extensive reading, got my PhD and so on, which my PhD wasn't actually in extensive reading. My primary love actually is vocabulary, and that's how I got into extensive reading. What I learned from my work in vocabulary was that there are what you might call physical limits to what you can learn from just intensive language instruction. There are limits to how much you can do. This is connected to something called Zipf's Law, which maybe you've heard about.
Yeah.
And it just tells you how many times you need to meet and if you add that to how many times you need to meet a word, plus the opportunity for learning, for individual words, it dictates to us how much text we need to meet in order to get the amount of repetitions that we need. And just simply the mathematics of language tells us what we need to do. Now, one way to do that would be through intensive language instruction, which we know has limits because we only have an hour or 2 hours a week.
Yeah.
But by meeting lots and lots of comprehensible and comprehended text at the right level, you're going to be meeting tens of thousands of words potentially a week, and therefore your opportunities for growth are there. You're meeting the necessary conditions of the number of repetitions that you need. And so what I was looking at when I first came to Japan was the standard classes was still, as we had always done, you get your textbook, your teacher, your grammar and your vocabulary, you give them a test. But there was none of the volume of language learning. And so I spoke to the director of the school I was working at the time in Osaka, a school that now doesn't exist anymore. We started an ER program there, and then basically things took off. I did my PhD, and as I was doing my PhD, I started with Mark Helgeson, Richard Day, Julian Bamford, Tom Robb, and the others. We started the ERSIG. We started some extensive reading colloquium in JOLT back in 1997. I got involved with getting a special edition on extensive reading in The Language Teacher back in 97, and then 10 years later, I did another one. We're probably due actually for a 20th anniversary. So after doing that, I just realized that there was just so much more to learn about extensive reading. And it was starting to make a difference, not only to me, but after, you know, Mark and Tom and all the rest of us had been doing this for a while, other people came in. They started to take over. We wanted to move the responsibility for the ER colloquiums to other people. They did, and it was great that after about 10 years or so, I was coming along to these sessions for the ERSIG colloquia at JOLT, thinking like, I don't even know who these people are presenting with me, you know, and which was great because the community had grown so much and grown in such a way that there were so many people coming in. And even now when I go to ER events, I can recognize lots of faces, but there are lots of faces I don't know, and that's a really good thing. That's how I got into extensive reading.
Then on top, vocabulary then.
Through vocabulary was largely my route. And then the more I did it, I had people coming up to me sort of saying like, you know, ER has changed my life. You know, it was just a way that they'd just seen their life as being a teacher who's get the textbook, they work through the textbook, they give students the test at the end. And that was what they thought teaching was all about. Then they realized that, you know, actually you can have meaning in there, you can have discussions, there's actual content can be brought into the classroom. And they were sort of saying it's really, you know, enabled me and the students to see language from a different perspective. And they just sort of, you know, got the bug and go with it. And now some of these people are some of the leading names in extensive reading, and many of whom have appeared on your podcast. So,
well, thanks for that. Mm. Yeah, how has ER changed since you started?
Well, of course, awareness is raised. I remember the first ER colloquia that we did back in the 90s, when I was with Mark and Tom and Julian and Richard. We'd talk to people and say, oh, what do you do? Oh, we do extensive reading. Oh, intensive reading. I've heard of that. No. This is extensive reading. So what's really changed now is you basically can talk to any teacher in Japan, and they will have heard of tadoku, or extensive reading. Whereas before they hadn't heard of it, or they kind of had sort of a vague idea, but yeah, that's not relevant. You know, that's something other people do if I've got spare time. And I think there's a growing realization that maybe extensive reading should be a part of what they do, even if they don't do it. There are still some people who resist. But I would say awareness is one. And I think a second one, a sort of growing thing, is a sense of guilt. I think there are people now realizing that they're beginning to get the message and realizing that, oops, I actually should be doing this, even though I'm not doing it. So there's a sense of, few people are starting to feel guilty, a sense of guilt that, you know, maybe I'm not really teaching, or my school's not really teaching the way it should do. We're a bit too traditional. But there's still that perception somewhere that something's missing, and extensive reading has kept being talked about. It's not something, not a fad that's gone away. People are still talking about it 20 years on. And Japan's famous for its fads, you know, this comes and this goes and this comes and this goes. But ER is still sticking out, still there. And so they're starting to slowly, slowly pay attention. Unfortunately, the government yet hasn't mandated extensive reading. But in time, I think they will. I think there are structural reasons why they don't.
You mentioned Zipf's Law. Could you explain that for our audience?
Zipf's Law. Okay, so basically what that says is... if you look at the most frequent word in English, which is the, it occurs about 7% of the time. So the first word in English occurs at 7% of the time. If you look at the second most frequent, let's say, family of words in English, which would be the be verb, that occurs roughly 3.5% of the time. So that's the second one. So if you multiply 2 by the 3.5, you get to 7, right? Mm-hmm. And then if you do the third most frequent one in English, which is about 2.6, multiply that, and you get this constant figure all the way down, which roughly equates to about 7. So the 1,000th most frequent word in English multiplied by its actual frequency will actually end up about the same number of about 7. And this is a constant, which is what they call Zipf's Law. And what that tells us is that we can very carefully or very accurately predict when a certain word is going to appear in text. This is just a law of the way that texts are structured in English. It may or may not apply to other languages, but I think it probably does. So we know, for example, in order to meet the 100 most frequent words in English, you'd need to have read, for example, I've forgotten the actual number, I think it's 350 words or something. Maybe not 350, anyway, something like that. So we know how many words you need to read to meet the first 100 most frequent words in English. We know, for example, the 1,000th most frequent word in English, mathematically, you have to read about 8,012 words, and you will then meet the 1,000th most frequent word in English. Mm-hmm. And if you continue that all the way down to the 10,000th, it gets up to, you know, quite a lot. We're talking about tens of thousands of words you need to meet just to meet it once. Time. Yeah, so when you're looking at that and the way that the vocabulary is structured in English, there are some forms which are more frequent or less frequent than other ones. And therefore, what that means is that once we know the frequency of certain items, how frequently they occur, then you can do the prediction of how long you're going to have to wait till you get it to meet that word. Then if we look at the next set of calculations, which is how long does it take to actually learn a particular word, so we multiply that by, let's say, 10 times or 12 times or 15 times, whatever. Put the two together, you can get a map for how much text needs to be covered, how many times in order to be able to provide the input that might be available for learning. So that's the sort of way that we look at the mathematics of language. And Paul Nation wrote a paper some years ago, and he's got a table which you can go through. Maybe you might want to put a link to it on your podcast or however you advertise. So, you know, that tells us quite clearly that there are certain words going to appear at certain frequencies. Now, unfortunately, the mathematics of language there is only looking at individual items. And the way that we typically count words is we throw, you know, huge numbers of words into a corpus, let's say a billion words or so. We run an analysis program, find out where words start and finish, which is where spaces are or periods or commas. And we then do our math from there. What it doesn't tell us is about collocations, right, or lexical phrases or second meaning senses or lots and lots of other stuff. And so there's a lot more that goes into the calculations of how much text is needed. And one of the things I'm working on right now is how frequent certain collocations are, how many times you'll need to meet how many words you need to meet before a collocation will appear again.
Mm-hmm.
In general text. I'm talking about academic text or something. I think the frequencies for collocations, because they're technically, there would be there'll be a part of the function of the text itself, because of the type of text engineering would have these same things appearing again and again. But for general text, I'm trying to work out the mathematics of how frequently collocations would appear or lexical phrases would appear. And what it looks like is that the average collocation is actually too frequent to be taught. So an example I sometimes give in my presentations, if you look at the collocation strong wind, the word strong appears, I think it's 230 times every million words. The word wind appears 30 times every million words, but strong wind appears 3 times every million words. So that says that you meet strong wind today, you now have to read 330,000 words and you will meet it again. 30,000 more, that's 5 more native books, and then you'll meet it again. So clearly, even a very transparent collocation like strong wind, which you can just pick up from your general knowledge because you know what strong and wind are, it's not opaque. That means that most collocations, even most obvious, quite clear collocations, are just simply not worth our time. What are worth our time are the collocations or the lexical phrases, false friends, words which in the first language and the second language have different meanings. Yeah, so a typical example happened just the other day. One of my students just said to me, what did you do on the weekend? She said, I played with my boyfriend. So I had to talk to her about the meaning of the way play exists differently as it does from our Sobawin Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
And then she was kind of a little bit embarrassed. But, you know, those are the kind of things we need to look at. You know, play with someone, that phrase is something we need to be very careful about. So, you know, what that tells me is that the only way we're going to master some of these collocations and collegations is through massive exposure. We just simply don't have time to identify what these collocations and collegations, lexical phrases are, and teach them one by one. Useful sentence heads, you know, very useful. Things like, do you mind if I, what do you think about, how about doing da 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 da? These sorts of things, absolutely, because they're great placeholders. But and they have very good functional and notional aspects to them. But for individual words, individual words may be okay up to a certain frequency level. Around the 2,500 word frequency level is where we basically need to stop the general vocabulary. Need to move on to more academic, more topic-based vocabulary.
Sure.
But most collocations aren't worth the time unless they are content-based. Let's say you're studying business, you'll need to know what these things are. Those collocations should be learned intentionally. Picking them up from text just isn't the way to do that. A technical vocabulary is much better to be picked up, at least a meaning sense, picked up intentional learning. And your content you're doing in your first language, let's say you're doing business or whatever, that will provide the schematic background, the contextual background, the conceptual background, which all you're then doing is adding a new English form for something you already know in your first language. So we've got sort of limits to what we can do. The other thing that makes a difference is whether the texts that we're analyzing are general texts or whether they are more specific texts, let's say technical texts. So if you look at, let's say, the language in graded readers, particularly the narrative, a lot of the words in those texts are very much like spoken language. When we look at the vocabulary of spoken language and that of written language, it's quite different. What we find is a tail off at around the 1,800, 1,900 level, where in spoken language, words tend to become, the middle frequency words, the rarer words, just simply start to not occur at all. So when we're looking at the text from movies, from graded readers, and from novels, it doesn't have many of the mid-frequency words, doesn't have many of the low-frequency words. And that's why we need to have texts which are non-fiction texts, which are, you know, informational texts at the sort of intermediate levels and above, because that's where the students are going to be needing to see the repetitions of words. But just doing graded readers won't help you with your technical vocabulary because of the limits of the type of text that we found in narrative.
Yeah, this is narrative-based.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Most of them, not all of them. Yeah. I'm very pleased that now we're getting more and more graded reader series out there which are more focused on the technical language, you know, more specific. So we're starting to see a few business readers at the market. We're starting to see, I'm hearing whispers around people doing more on STEM. We're starting to see, you know, Bookworms has got a few fact files out there. Nat Geo's come out with their eco series and so on. And that's all great. But there's still a massive gap for those people learning these content topics. They don't get that supported practice. They have to deal with native texts, which makes it really, really hard for them.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for that. So this need to, I mean, the need for massive exposure, do you think that would be the most compelling reason to do extensive reading? Or can you tell us about other good reasons to do extensive reading?
I think it's the one that's so brain dead obvious. The mathematics of language just screams at us. If you don't do it, then you're simply not going to get the repetitions. So you can say, a teacher can say, okay, I don't want to do this. I don't want to do extensive reading. I say, okay, fine. Then don't do it. Don't get your students to do it. Where are they going to get the massive repetition of language? Where are they going to see all these phrases? How are they going to build their reading speed? How are they going to build a sense of language to know how the words and grammar go together? Now, what I was talking about previously was only about individual items. Generally speaking, what we pick up when we talk about acquisition, the uptake rate of vocabulary was only for individual items, you know, 10 times or 12 times or 15 times. We have some data on collocations. It seems to be less, actually, than it does for individual items.
Less repetitions necessarily.
Less repetition. Yeah, because you already know the two or three parts that go with the collocation.
Yeah.
So unless it's really, really opaque. But what that says is that, you know, there are going to be some limits to what we can do. But there are times we need to have intentional practice. There's definitely we need to have that. But the problem is that in order to learn a language, you're not just learning individual pieces of the language, like, you know, pieces of a jigsaw. You've got to see how they go together. You know, how do we fit the language together? And particularly colligation is really important, where we see how certain words go together. We say depend on, we say rely on someone, we say give something to someone. And verbs particularly dominate a sentence. The verb itself can only have a certain type of subject. Give can only have a giver who can give something. A picture can't give you anything. Not in a normal sense, in a metaphorical sense it could do. And a give implies a direct physical object, usually, not always, and then to someone. So the properties of the verb give itself dictate what kinds of words go as subjects, what kinds of words go as objects. And so working on verbs is really, really crucial. And these colligations, the relationship between why we say give something to someone or give someone something, is really key for students. Again, we don't have time often to tell students what these things are. So they need to pick up this sense of what's feeling right, what feels right. And that sense of language is something we cannot teach. No teacher can teach that.
That's implicit learning, right?
It's implicit learning, exactly. Right, that implicit learning, they've just got to pick it up. And we can't do anything else except expose them to massive amounts of text. We can say, okay, only do your textbook, but where are they going to get the repetitions? How are they going to teach all these collocations? There is no way around this. I mean, whether we like it or whether we don't like it, that's just the way language is. I mean, there's hardly anybody in the world would say, you don't need to talk to a child to learn your first language. Everybody knows, everybody on the planet knows children need to speak and read and write a lot to learn their first language. Why are we not doing this in a second language? It's just so obvious, right? So, and should be faster because, of course, you've now got the native, the adult thinking skills. We've got our analytical skills. We've got our ability to evaluate things and to synthesize knowledge, which young kids don't have. So we should be able to pick up language faster than first language children.
And yet.
And yet. There's two possible questions. One question I wanted to ask is if you could tell us about other ER-related projects or different projects you're involved with.
Oh, my gosh, one... where do I start?
Okay, sorry.
Where do I start?
Okay. Give me just 1 second. Sure. The other possible avenue would be your take on the right balance of input and output debate. And I don't know, what would you like to ask about? What would you like to talk about?
Sure. Well, my own view about the output debate, it really, there shouldn't be a debate. I mean, as far as I see it, the way I think that people learn, or one way that adults learn, less children, but more adults, is I think production helps us to pull together pieces of knowledge. If you're only absorbing knowledge, if you're only putting knowledge into the networks, into your head, you aren't sure whether you put them into the right positions or not. You connected the right words, connected the right collocations, and so on. You're never really sure until you've tried it out. When you tried something out, you've then got a feedback loop, either from the person listening to you, or the red pen of the teacher, or somebody smiling or laughing at what you say. You've got a feedback loop that says whether your knowledge is right or wrong. So to me, the output is, while you could argue it not necessary, let's just say it's common sense for students to try out their knowledge, to find out what they know and what they don't know, what works and what doesn't work, the hypotheses that have been arranging in their head, do they work or do they not work? And if they do work and the conversation's smoothing, okay, then I confirm that my knowledge is okay. If they find some kind of a bump, a hiccup, there's a red pen or somebody goes, huh? Then you realize there's a problem. And that's good feedback knowledge that helps you notice. So I talk about something called the cycle of learning, that you first notice something, you add your knowledge to that, you make a new connection of some description, you then try out the knowledge to see how it works. You get net feedback from outside, which then helps you notice what you know and you don't know, either confirming what you know or disconfirming what you know. So therefore, you have to reformulate your thesis. So we have this cycle of learning which goes around and around and around for lots of things. So without that output, it's going to be taking longer because you only have to rely on input and modifying. Because we know that you've got a cognitive bias. You may, and there was some research that Bhatia Laufer did some years ago. I think it was Bhatia and one of her PhD students in Israel, looked at how students will reinterpret a text if they've got the wrong meaning of a word. They will understand the text differently and don't get the meaning that was, let's say, the author might have intended, so to speak. And they reframe their comprehension. So if the students are constantly doing this, then clearly they aren't going the right way. They're building up networks which are maybe incorrect, that would take a lot longer to change because cognitive bias works against us. So what that says is that by forcing students to give feedback, they will find out more quickly, more soon, that in fact what they're saying isn't actually correct, and they need to adjust their collocations, the words that they use, the word choice, or whatever it would be. So I don't see this as a debate. To me, this is just simply, of course, yeah, of course you need to have some output. That would be the way I look at it.
Yeah, let me ask a few.
You're smiling.
No, I'm just thinking of my own classes where I'm teaching Spanish, not English
right.
anymore. I'm teaching Spanish at a university. I have university students of Spanish, and they're very like the beginners, and I can't really do meaningful output in the
meaningful output. Yeah,
yeah, like if sure. they, I can do like classic information gaps.
Yep,
but here. This like this wouldn't match the scenario you were describing before.
No, not,
because
not.
I mean, first they're not going to be speaking to a native speaker who can not understand what they're trying to put out. So
doesn't always necessarily work that way. What I talked about giving the opportunity to give output, to practice something. That practice could be controlled. It could be, for example, in a very controlled environment where we're even doing a dialogue, A-B dialogue, and where they might change some words, for example, and bring something in and that doesn't work. I've got the wrong word. So it could be through controlled language work as well, even as controlled as a dialogue or a information gap with certain exponents that students need to use. So it works at that level as well, but also works at the more productive, more free level where they're able to choose the words for themselves. In a controlled activity, as you know, the text or what they're supposed to say is largely controlled by the task or by the teacher. So it still applies in that way. You've still got that noticing, whether it's in a controlled, more controlled environment or in a less controlled environment. But they need to have both. If we keep them under control all the time, then they're only going to be dealing with what we give them. So they need to step out of that at some point and have their own free practice, sort of extend maybe what you're talking about. Let's say, for example, you're giving them some exponents for what to say in a restaurant, in a McDonald's or whatever. You might extend that to, okay, what would you say if you went to a sushi restaurant? What would you say if you now bought a ticket? What would you say? So let them think about how they can connect what they're learning from one into another one. So that sort of move them away from where they are. So it still holds, I think, this idea of taking them through this cycle of learning.
Okay. I agree. I fully agree.
There you go.
Thank you.
Oh, that's great.
I think we'll stop there. We got to prepare for our next interview. That was wonderful.
All right. Well, my pleasure. If anybody wants to follow up that with me, my email address is waring.rob@gmail.com. Please feel free to do so. I'm not sure when you're going to release this, but anybody can get in contact with me. Go to my websites. I would implore you to look at the ercentral.com/teachers area, the teachers tab. That's got lots of information about extensive reading there for you to have a look at, to read up before you ask me some questions. But if anybody's interested in doing some research into extensive reading, please get in touch with me. There are people who do get in touch, and I sometimes find out that they've been doing things for a year and they've been asking the wrong questions or asking in the wrong way or whatever. I've got some resources that maybe they would help, that could help them as well. So please get in touch.
Well, thank you. Thank you. So I might take up that offer.
Yep. Go ahead. Right after this call. Yeah, we can certainly.
Good. So that was our first part, the first part of our interview with Rob Waring. So, Travis, how did you like it?
It was great. I really appreciated him giving us an overview of Zipf's Law and just about the distribution of words in English, in the English language, and how many words you would need to read to come across some of these words. And just, it was interesting.
Yeah, there's one thing I liked about that is that I've heard that before, but I hadn't listened to anybody talking about colligation and like not just collocation but also the way, as he said, verbs dominate the sentence and mm-hmm. which prepositions go with which verbs, etc. Which I would call subcategorization. Like he said, it depends on. Like for us Spanish speakers, we tend to say it depends of, and sure. so we realize sure. that's wrong. That's because of the influence of the mother tongue, and I think you really don't have the time to study intentionally all the different colligations of prepositions and verbs. And if you're not going to get massive exposure,
there's no way you're going to
pick that up.
So you made a really strong case for extensive reading. That was great.
Yep. we didn't mention that. We forgot to mention Paul Goldberg.
Speaking of which, we meant to put this in our intro, but if you're sticking out for the... If you're continuing with the outro, we... give you a special treat. Paul Goldberg said it really well about Rob Waring. He said,
"Yeah, that nobody makes a case for extensive reading as Rob Waring does, and that if he's talking about extensive reading and someone in the room doesn't feel extensive reading is necessary, he's gonna feel really stupid, or maybe he's gonna change
his mind. He's changed his mind. So we hope you feel the same mm-hmm. after this episode.
And also it was nice to hear Rob Waring's views on the output, what we call the output debate. And
he said there shouldn't be a debate.
The role of output. I would like to say what output, because it's important that we remember that when we say output, we, at least in this podcast, we mean meaningful output, not just parroting, not just repeat after me.
Yeah, and he kind of addressed that, talking about controlled activities and then moving to more freer exercises. So hopefully, I know you said you struggled with that with your Spanish students.
Yeah, I think it's not as easy as some people might think. But
yeah, I mean, it's easy to talk about, but when we all know, teaching ain't easy.
Okay, so
I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
Next week.
Yeah. So next week we'll have the second part of this interview, and it will deal with a completely different topic, which is the author of Graded Readers and the editor of Graded Readers, and it will link with those two episodes we had with Antoinette Moses and Nick Bollett.
And as we hinted earlier, we'll really talk about foundations.
Yeah, foundations reading. The Foundations Reading Library.
And page turners.
And page turners a little bit. We said we're going to give the audience some
homework.
I love those books, and I really think that you should read them. And because they're for beginners, it doesn't take much time. They're easy to find because they're very popular. So, and you will appreciate the second part of the interview. Mm-hmm. Much better if you've been acquainted with those books. So again, it's the Foundations Reading Library.
Do you have a favorite?
Do I have a favorite? Well, I like Rain, Rain, Rain. And he talks about it during the interview. So yeah, that would be a good one.
Oh, you got, you got, you got spoilers, me off guard. Right? He gives a spoiler for Rain, Rain, Rain. Is that right?
Yeah, so hurry and read it. And then I think Do It. There's another one called Do It. And that was very good. Yeah, those two are very good.
Good. That's it. Well, there's your homework.
Yeah.
Get to it.
And that'll do it for today. Please keep on sending us your feedback. And as I said, sharing us with the world. If you want to send us an email, we are at exrpodcast@gmail.com. We can find us on iTunes, and we also have a website which is called erpodcast.wordpress.com, where you can find the show notes for where we put out some links and some short descriptions of the people who interview and the interviews. And I think that's it.
That'll do it.
Okay.
Until next week.
Yeah. Happy reading.